Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Joint Committee on Public Safety. It's Friday, February 15th, and it is 1:03 p.m. Going to open up an informational hearing at this time. We have invited testimony today, and besides having kind of a continued review and discussion of where we left off Wednesday for the Governor's Public Safety Commission report, we've also invited John Foote, District Attorney from Clackamas County, to come up and discuss a little bit about their perspective on the forecast. And then you're also bringing Don Reese with you, John, and also Bob Herman, too, okay, if you come forward then.
Good morning, Chair.
Good morning, members of the committee.
Good afternoon, I guess. It's afternoon. My name is John Foote. I'm the DA in Clackamas County, and I was a member of the Public Safety Commission along with four of your members. Thank you for inviting us today. And maybe Don and Bob can introduce themselves. So.
Good afternoon, Chair Witters, Chair Brzezinski, Chair Olson, Chair Garrett, and other members. Thank you for having me. I'm Don Reese, Chief Deputy DA in Multnomah County. And also since 2005, I've been serving on the Governor's Corrections Forecast Advisory Group.
Good afternoon, Chairs. I'm Bob Herman, the District Attorney in Washington County, and also serving as the Vice President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and here in that capacity today.
If I could just go ahead and start. And again, thank you for this opportunity, and we've got some PowerPoint slides to show you, but obviously, when there are any questions or you want to, just please let us know. Just what we want to do today is do a couple things. We want to kind of go over the history of prison forecasting as we kind of looked at it, and Don will do a lot of that, and then I'll make a couple of remarks as well. And then we'll conclude with kind of a look at what the current population has been doing that we have looked at. Is anything up on there? Good. First of all, we'd like you to know that the forecast, even though we're going to point out to you it's too high, even the forecast says growth is going to be modest. 16% over 10 years, which is less than 2% a year. And that, I think that's important to put in context. Also, this report that the forecasters put together, and that's really our source of information, their aspiration is to have forecasts that are both high and low, because that's sort of how forecasting should work. And you're going to see that that's been lacking in the past. We'll point that out to you as we go. And this slide was in the alternative report, but we thought you might want to see it again, because we know that there's a concern that growth in prisons is going to be unsustainable. And while we all want to manage money carefully, and I think our alternative report is trying to help with that, even if you just look at the raw numbers, prison growth in Oregon should not be unsustainable, particularly when you factor in the fact that the forecast currently says that more than 50% of prison growth is going to be caused by Oregon's population growth, not sentencing policy. So that brings a tax base, theoretically, never enough, obviously, but it's not necessarily unsustainable. That's our real point. So with that, I think it's your turn.
One of the things that we can do now, thanks really to state economist Mark McMullen, who I think has done an admirable job of trying to determine why this forecast has historically been highly inaccurate, is that he's put together a
So maybe before we do that, I should talk about this just for a second.
Okay.
Reintroduce yourself in this.
John Foote again. Sorry. This particular slide shows you the last 14 10-year prison forecasts. It was a different looking chart in the alternative report, but it should be the same information. It was transferred over, and you can see that every one of those 14 was high. And the first four were really high. And those were the four after Measure 11, when there was just way too much over-predicting on who was going to prison, despite our attempts to dissuade folks that it wasn't going to happen. But after that, it pretty much stabilizes anywhere from 5 to almost 8% very consistently for 10 forecasts in a row. And if you take that percentage and average it, the last 10, not the first, if you add the others, it's over 15% high on average. But let's just set those four aside as kind of a different animal. The last 10 average out to a little over 6.5% high on average. If you multiply that times the current forecast, it's over 1,000 bets high. So we're not saying we know that. We're saying it's the first step in being cautious about believing that the forecast is right. So having said that, Dom will now walk you through the numbers that the forecasters have put together.
All right. So just briefly, what we'd like to present to you is something that the Office of Economic Analysis has put together. This is available online, and it's a report on the historical accuracy, or as it turns out, inaccuracy of the prison population forecast. And this allows us to see how the forecast has played out over time, beginning 10 years ago with the April 2003 forecast. And you see the blue line, the lower of the line is the actual prison population, and the red dotted line above was the projected increase in prison beds. And as you can see, although in the very short term it was accurate, very quickly the actual prison population levels out in a very steady, even method of growth, while the projected, the forecast prison population continues to move upward. And we now know, looking back 10 years, that that forecast was inaccurate. And moving forward in time, in this report that's issued every 6 months, twice a year, in April and October, we see again that this forecast was wrong, and it was high every time, 20 times over the last 10 years. The forecast, as you see in April 2004, was calling for over 17,000 beds by the end of 2013. And in fact, we know now that we are many thousands short of that. Again, October 2004, you can see the projection of growth moving up to the top of the graph, but the reality was the actual prison population was staying relatively stable with very modest growth. I'll mention that what is now clear in 2013 that much of this growth, and we've been told by the state economist it's anywhere from 50 to 62% of the growth in the prison population is being driven not by sentencing laws, but by the increase in Oregon's population, largely by immigration from other states, California, putting new people into the state. And of course, a small percentage of those new Oregonians are going to end up in Department of Corrections. For policymakers, that really changes the analysis of what this means in terms of the growth, because these new Oregonians are going to bring new revenue to the state.
John Foote again, if I could just point out, this slide and the next one are the year that Deer Ridge, construction of Deer Ridge started, which either had, it's either 1,800 or 2,100 beds, and today it has 600 inmates in it.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead, Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I appreciate this because as a statistician, every year they take the new information to predict the next one. And as you can see, the projection line is getting more in line with the actual because it takes the actual into account. And it appears, I mean, I haven't seen the last two, but if I look at the final 2 years, its growth rate was equal to the original pattern. So it'd be interesting to see how if it flattens and comes back up, because those early years, we know they were way off, even in the 10. Theoretically, the more information and data you get, they redo that, and it should come into more alignment and get to be better and better data, would be my understanding. I mean, as a mathematician, I would hope that it does, or we've got some other kind of problem.
Well, Senator Roblin, that's an excellent point. One of the observations of the new state economist, Mark McMullen, is that an economist would expect that over time, a forecast like this would sometimes come in high and sometimes low. And that would tell the economist that the numbers going in were proper. What we're seeing, however, in this historic look back is that in every forecast, it's always high. And so the state economist is telling us there's indicating there's something wrong with the numbers that are being used to drive this forecast, because it over this 10-year look back, it was always wrong, and it was always high. See, now, and maybe, John Foote, you want to mention this projected spike in the April 2009 forecast.
If you remember, this is when Measure 57 was passed by the voters, and there was an estimate on its impact. And I do want to also sort of go back and remind us all that that was a very vigorous debate about what that was going to mean. And if the DAs actually made an effort, and I think we were asked to do this actually by the legislature, but we created a fact sheet for every Measure 57 case we handled, and every deputy DA had to fill it out statewide about what that deputy DA was handling the case thought would be the impact on the change in 57 from the former repo law, which we had before. How much would the person have gone or not, and if they before, and if they did go, would they be going for the same length or more? And we kept that for a full 6 months before the budget was passed, and we provided that information via Kevin Neely to the legislature, and it showed far less growth in 57 than that forecast. We knew that forecast was wrong, and we tried to tell people with no success. So I think that's an important event for folks to sort of understand. And you'll see it happen again when 57 comes back in a couple of slides.
Hey, Don, just, I mean, not that I want to push you or anything like that, but you've got about 25 more minutes for, and I know right now you're getting bogged down a little bit with some of the questions, so if you could kind of hold questions.
Sure. We'll just... Sure. Thank you. Representative Olson, let me just move ahead to the last few. Of course, close in time, just like a weather forecast where, as I heard on the radio this morning, it was going to be a beautiful day today, and sure enough it is, they're pretty accurate. We know that as you move out in that seven-day weather forecast, it becomes inaccurate, and so it is with this forecast. It is, in the long term, inaccurate largely, and again, over the last 10 years, always on the high side, and this brings us up to
slide. John Foote. Okay. Slide 17 was when Measure 58. I mean, 57 came back. I believe. Actually, it came back in 2012, didn't it? January 2012. So I misspoke. It's slide. Slide 22.
Yeah, which is here. So. Before turning this back over to John Foote, I would just like to make a final note as a member of the governor's correction population forecasting advisory group to clarify a point that's been it's been suggested that because a DA, myself, and previously Jason Carlisle, the elected district attorney from Linn County, because we've been members of this advisory group, that somehow that we have always agreed with the prison population forecast, and that's simply not the case. And we have jointly, that is DA Carlisle and myself, we have sent letters and emails to other members of the forecast group with really a similar message that I'm discussing with you now, which is that we believe that policymakers need to view the prison population forecast with caution, because historically it has been inaccurate in the long term, and it has been overstating the need for additional prison beds. That's not a criticism of the state economist at all. It is largely a function of this forecasting tool. But time and again, we know that the forecast of overpredicted prison growth, especially as the result of anti-crime measures 11, 61, and 57, we believe it is continuing to do so, and that claims that we're facing an explosion in prison growth or mushrooming growth are simply not supported by recent history, and we believe in the future as well.
If I could, again, we're getting close to the end, so we should have plenty of time for any questions you might have. This slide is interesting because we looked at the first 4 months of the current forecast, which was in October. And you can see what's going on. Right now, the forecast says we should have 129 more inmates in prison than we had in October. We have 50. And after that, I sort of, Chuck French and I have been looking at Chuck's, if you know Chuck French, he's a former deputy DA and certifiably smart. And he does a lot of mining for data. And he let me know that over the last 44 months, the prison population has grown on an average of slightly less than 10 inmates a month over the last 44 months. Now, I got to say, during that time, Measure 57 was suspended for a while. So that probably played a part. But the last 8 months, Measure 57 has now been back in effect for 14 months. So give it some time to really take effect. It takes time for people to be arrested and prosecuted and convicted and sentenced. So take the last 8 months. The average has been almost exactly 12 more inmates per month. If you take the first 4 months before the forecast, there were 47 more inmates in that 4 months. And in the last 4 months, there have been 50. So it's a very steady, now it doesn't look steady on the red line, but the overall effect is steady. And it kind of fits in this pattern of the previous 36 months of much slower growth. Now, I think it takes time but to figure this out, but we believe it's because sentencing policy has stabilized. As you know, the current forecast says that Measure 11 is not going to increase beds in the future because it has stabilized intakes and releases. It's fairly straightforward. As a mathematician, Ms. Senator Rubin, you know this. Even somebody like me who's not can figure that much out. So what does this all mean? Well, I'd like to suggest that this is a window of opportunity to take a step back for a moment about what we have to do to control prison population. As you know, the governor's budget says that his budget is constructed around the idea of capping beds at 14,600. I think that's right. And there's a savings of about 700 beds, theoretically, because we won't have the forecast number of 15,300. And that's the $28 million that he saves, or that the budget saves. And what I'd suggest to you, if you take this average of 12 a month for the next 2 years and 4 months, we will end up with 14,000, about 630 inmates, which is very close to where the governor wants to cap it. Now, we're all looking into the future. This is all estimation, right? I mean, it is. The good news is there are 2,200 prison beds that are empty right now. We don't have to build anything. We've got time to see if this holds, if we're right. And if we're not, we have time to do something about it. It has certainly been the more recent pattern. And we would suggest the historical forecast is just not the right tool right now to be making this decision this right now. The forecasters who are working hard to improve the forecast need time. They need time for this to play out more. We're going to get another forecast in April. But we'd suggest to you, if we did some modest things that don't necessarily take on all the difficult subjects of sentence reform for violent criminals and repeat property criminals, which everyone knows is a fight that none of us really want to have, we can do this reasonably and monitor it for the next few years. And if something changes, we can all agree to come back and work on it. That's the good news, we think, and all of this information is that the forecast is much better than it looked like or what we've been told. I would suggest 2,300 inmates and $600 million is just not reality. Not right now. Maybe in the future, not right now. It's just not what we're looking at if you look at the real data. Last slide, if I could. Oh, and by the way, the prison growth that's going on right now is slower than Oregon's population growth. Again, that's good news. Last, just again, put the historical perspective. The last 10 one-year forecasts, 9 have been high. The last 10 two-year forecasts, 9 have been high. The last 10 five-year forecasts, 10 have been high. And the last 10-year forecasts, all 10 have been high. So this just tells us this forecast is too high. It's just not right. And we don't have to do something drastic to deal with the problem. So that's really kind of how we see this, is how it fits into how we do things. And again, we, on behalf of the district attorneys, Bob and I, and Don, we very much appreciate coming to talk to you, and we welcome your questions.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. I have a few questions. What was your, can you say again, on average, by what percent the 10-year forecast has been high, and you say the 10 of the last 10. Just give us a sense of how inflated it's been.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, and again, I'm not a mathematician, but I just took a calculator out, and I did the last 10. I added them up and divided them by 10, and I got 6.65% high on average. And then if I multiply that times at 16,500 or whatever it is, a forecast, it's about 1,100 inmates. Now, that's just, you know, on the top of my head, but that's been the pattern.
Okay. So if this 10-year forecast that we're working from is high by 7%, then the current projection of 2,300 additional beds would be off by how much?
Well, it'd be a little higher than 1,100. It might be 7 times 16,400 would be, I don't know, 1,200, 1,300 beds maybe, something like that. But I'm suggesting that it's even getting slower right now.
Okay. Now, you've talked about, mind if I ask a follow-up?
Go ahead.
This is all about the 10-year forecasts. But do you agree that the short-term forecasts have historically been pretty accurate?
Representative Garrett, co-chairs, I've heard that before. Of course, we heard it on the commission when I raised this issue. But as that slide showed you, the last 10 one-year forecasts, 9 have been high. Now, is it more accurate? I'm sure it is. I really haven't studied it. But it looks right now, again, going back to the real numbers, that it's not right now.
Okay. I mean, I've been informed that the last 10 two-year forecasts have been within about a percentage point. They may all be high by a percent, but
yeah,
they're not dramatically high. So the reason for the question, of course, is the 10-year forecast, which you're disputing, shows that most of that growth is actually going to be concentrated in the first 2 years of the 10.
Mm-hmm.
So if our short-term forecasting is substantially accurate, then we've got a problem even if our 10-year forecast is off. Don't you agree?
Representative Garrett, members of the committee, I know that that's a feeling, and I know that Director Peters feels that way. I see it different. And I just look at the current trend in the last 44 months to be contrary. The growth is much slower. And I just think we need to slow down a little bit. And the concern I have is the reasons why the forecast is always high. What's the agenda? Why does it always have to be high? And so I urge caution about this. I just don't see it. And the thing that matches with that is we have 2,200 empty beds. And I know Director Peters has a, you know, why that is and why she needs a certain percentage, you know, and we see it, I might debate it. But the number is real. And so when it's not about building things. And I don't know where the 600, nobody's ever explained to me what the 600 million is. It must be building a new prison, and I just don't understand why we need to do that right now. So that would be how I'd answer.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say something and thank the district attorneys. When we were fighting the major 57 battles in the building, there were people, and you were going to track those. People said, well, of course, they're not everybody, but there were skeptics who said they're going to, as gatekeepers, they were artificially not put people in prison to make this number look good, and then wait till it's over and the numbers will take off. And I want to thank you for having accurate descriptions there and not having things take off, not doing some artificial slowdown of convictions and sentences. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barker. I will tell you that I used to hear that, and I mean, that just would be a violation, in my opinion, of our duties to use individual cases that way. And we're usually accused of throwing the book at people, so it was kind of a curious thing to be accused of.
Senator Winters.
I'm trying to wrap my head around all this forecasting, because everybody that does forecasting, they do it based on budget. And when you're crafting your budget, what kind of forecasting do the DAs use? Because, you know, you too have to talk about caseloads and your work. So I'm kind of curious as whether or not you even use this particular tool as you prepare your own budgets.
Co-Chair Winters and members of the committee, and of course Bob can answer that for his office, but I'll just share you, and I was in corrections for 5 years, so I went back and talked to Colette this week and kind of had her talk to us a little bit, and it reminded me of how big and complicated the corrections budget is compared to the Clackamas County DA's budget. So they are a little bit like apples and oranges here. But there are advantages to being that big, because you have more money to play with. So the disadvantages in being small is that we don't. But the other thing is, in DA's offices, we don't do it by case counts, because they're just, our prosecutors are expected to take the cases that walk through the door, and we manage it. And, you know, some of the years they'll have 150 cases each, and some years they'll have 100. And, or, I know when I was in Multnomah County, it was a lot more than that. But, and then, of course, if it gets too much, then you go and talk to the commissioners. But it's much more flexible than it is. And I would submit there's a little bit of that in corrections, too, because when you add beds to an existing facility, it actually gets cheaper per inmate. But that's obviously an area for Director Peters with her expertise.
Senator Brzezinski.
Don, I appreciate you being on the forecasting group. Can you remind me, I know that the Secretary of State did an audit and determined that the forecast system that we had, the formula, which I believe was all under the Department of Corrections at that time, was not the most appropriate way to do it, and based on the numbers. So we've talked about historical perspective of the forecast. Do you remember when that change occurred, where it actually went to the Department, the economist and this team?
Chair Brzezinski and members, I don't know precisely. It is in the fairly near term that change has been made, and as I say, I think credit is due the work of Mark McMullen, the state economist. They are doing, I think, a better job. They're trying to be more accurate in terms of the kinds of numbers that are coming in. They've added census information to capture the natural population growth in the state, with, in particular, that portion which is considered at risk and which is deemed more likely to move into DOC. They're also trying to adjust the forecast. They have recognized that it's been running high, and they've been pushing that number down. And I anticipate in the upcoming April forecast, which we'll have a preview of, that is, the committee will have a preview of in March, I anticipate that the number is going to move down further in that projection, and for the reason, as is shown on the slide, or if we could have that slide again, where we took just month by month since October, we're already seeing that the actual numbers are running below the projected, and I think in large part that's because of the actual impact of Measure 57, which is less than forecast. That was a long answer to your question.
So let me follow up.
Yeah.
It sounds to me what I'm hearing, if I'm correct, is that based on this
revision we've done is how the forecasting's done. It's getting better. It's getting closer. And so it brings me back to what Representative Garrett brought up regarding the short-term forecast of them being closer. Now, I heard what John said. They've always been high, 9 out of 10. But if it's only 1%, then it seems like we're getting much closer to the real numbers. Is that a fair assessment?
Senator Przanski, I think I would not agree with that assessment, and I would just go directly to the language from the Office of Economic Analysis, which states in its summary that we can expect very modest growth by historical standards, and that the population estimate is highly uncertain and subject to change. Yes, the forecast is getting better, but the people who are creating this forecast are the first ones to say it must be viewed with a great deal of caution and a great deal of uncertainty. And so I think policymakers would be well advised to take that into consideration.
Yeah, but that seems to me like any forecast. A forecast is just a guesstimation, hopefully the best estimate based on the scientific data and the formula that's used. But you always should be cautious, not knowing exactly what's going to be the actual play, because it could be up or it could be down.
Well, but again, we know during the last 10 years,
I'm not looking in the last 10 years. Well, I'm looking now that we have a new model that we're using. To me, that's the starting point. Yes, historically, we can see that we've made that correction from what I understand. And if we've made that correction, it seems like looking since that correction's been made, going forward, we should get more accurate representation of what we believe will occur based on those factors.
Senator Przanski, if I might just jump in and say,
I'd really like to have Don, since he's been part of the group, because he's the one that's actually been there as compared to you or me.
Senator Przanski, again, I don't know if that's correct. Of course, we won't know until 10 years from now whether ultimately that projection was correct. But I would say that out of the gate, we already know since the time of the October forecast, it's running high.
And how high?
Well, on this graph, it is significantly high enough to indicate, I think, that it's off track once again. I mean, I guess it would be like taking a patient's temperature with a thermometer that was wrong every time and high every time. At some point, you would be committing malpractice to use that faulty thermometer.
Senator Przanski, if I could just also suggest that the forecast is done every 6 months. So when it's off short term, it gets quickly corrected,
right,
which makes it more accurate. But it still hasn't fixed the fundamental problem. And that's the first thing. And the second thing is, what's the best predictor of future behavior? Past behavior. Past behavior tells us this is wrong. And there is just so much overwhelming evidence that it's wrong that I think we have to assume it's wrong until somebody shows us different. That's what I would suggest. While we don't know, everything, the short term and the long term, tells us this is wrong. Thank you.
Senator Roebling.
A couple of quick questions, because I'm not sure. This last one that was done 4 months ago was an annual projection for the year, right?
It was a 10-year with it every month.
Okay, with the month. So as I look at that from a mathematical perspective, it has missed. But if it continues on the recent path, it's going to cross it and get caught up again. So it was short, the first three. The next one was at a steeper decline, incline. So eventually it could be very accurate by the time you know. So we don't know. I will say the one thing, it has consistently been your 10-year annual one showed that 6% approximately. They missed by 6% almost every year high, which means that the model is probably pretty accurate. It's got something in it that's adjusting high, but if you can't miss that close the same every time without having good data in, it's like a very good marksman. Most of us have a try to hit the one place, and we have a hard time doing that. Good marksmen can find any place they want and pick, and people would say that was an inaccurate shot when in fact it was accurate. So I'm just saying, from a standpoint of a model, if you have a model that is acting consistently, even if it's off, It's sometimes better than the one that's going up and down that you don't have any predictability about. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't take into consideration each time that it happened that it was a little high. So I understand what you're saying there. Just I'm not sure that the whole model is wrong. And I hopefully they will do some corrections to get the model to act better. But mathematically, it's just as rare to, like you were saying, the most models would go up and down and all around. When it's consistently the same, that's kind of a unique situation in a mathematical model. It says, wow, they've got something right in this model, or it wouldn't be patterning that way. And the other thing that I guess that I want to just ask you guys, all of you as DAs, I understand because we build budgets on these projections, and therefore it's really important to understand where they are. But at the same time, as an educator in my business, and that's what I'm trying to figure out as I make these comparisons, you know, we test things over and over again, and sometimes we're very good at accurately at predicting them. But that doesn't mean we did the right thing educationally. I mean, it means that we can predict how we're doing it because we keep doing the same thing the same way, and it gets really predictable. We should have done better by making them better educated or better whatever. So what I'm looking at, too, is are there really good models that would actually change the curve so it goes down because we have opportunities in our society to help people become better as opposed to just looking at traditions that would keep us doing the same thing we've always been doing. So, you know, for me, part of the whole process that was going through was to look at what are the best practices out there and can Oregon learn from some of those because we've been the leader in a lot of those best practices. You guys have been the leaders in some of those best practices. I mean, it really has been. So, to me, the projection is less important than how we tip those things and do things. Any suggestions with regard to best practices and other
ideas? Honorable members of the committee, if I could just kind of roll back from it and then get
sure.
to that, because
I'm sorry, I'm a little ADD, so I go back and forth. So.
If it was just 4 months we were talking about,
a lot of chocolate.
Right.
I think that's a better argument.
And
we're
I know.
Talking about last 42 months.
Oh, no, I agree. I'm just saying, not even that. The 10-year thing was really surprising to me to be as accurate as they were by off
right.
the same amount all the time. I mean, I'm just saying that.
I agree with that. I agree with everything you're saying, except that you suggested this might correct itself. But the problem is this growth of 10 to 12 a month has been going on for 44 months.
Right.
And so it's not just 4 months. It's just getting kind of more steady in a way. So
okay.
that's my first comment.
Okay. And so I appreciate
it's not just,
that.
I agree. The smaller the snapshot, the less useful it is.
Gotcha.
The second is... now I forgot what your question. It was about
best practices and that kind of stuff. I mean, we don't care about this curve. Maybe what we really care about is how do we do the right things with respect to getting the appropriate prisoners where they belong and the people who can actually contribute to society where they belong and make us safe communities at the same time we're doing this.
Well, that's a vigorous discussion.
I agree.
And we have some ideas in the alternative report, and we'd love to engage in that.
Okay.
And there
I'd
are people here who have their ideas. Going back to the 10-year and how it's always off the same, though I would suggest then just chop the four guys by 6%, 7%.
I mean,
and you got a much better picture. You don't have 2,300 and 600 million anymore. So
right.
that's our first point.
Right.
Our second point is, it's even getting slower in the last 44 months. So I'm not saying
yeah.
we know. We're not saying that. We're not forecasters. We don't have a. All we're saying is, all the indicators are. We don't need to do something as drastic as what's been proposed. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you,
Don. Since you've been on this forecast group and took over for my old DA down there in Linn County, Jason Carlisle, have you brought forth what historically the forecasting has been to the group?
Well, it's been brought forth by the state economist.
Right.
And the state economist has again and again issued these reports with caution, and the cautions are built into the report in the fine print, you might say, at the bottom. It seems as if what grabs the headlines are that 10-year forecast and the big number at the end. And it seems as if the part where the state economist explains the inherent dangers of relying on that long-term forecast as tends to get ignored. And that's one of the reasons why we're very grateful to have the chance here this afternoon to talk about why this, in our view, should be viewed with a great deal of caution and why it's simply not the case that Oregon sentencing laws are pushing and mushrooming growth. It just doesn't appear to be the case, and it's been a topic of conversation among the members of our committee. And it's in the fine print in the report, and I expect it to be there again in April when the latest prison population forecast comes out.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Back on the question of the 10-year forecast and the accuracy, is there any way to know how the accuracy of those forecasts would have been improved over time if the legislature hadn't enacted changes to sentencing policy in the middle of those 10 years? Could we even find a 10-year period of time that's gone by when we haven't somehow altered the sentencing code itself, which obviously has to have some effect on the bed count?
Chair Garrett and members of the committee, I think that's a really good question, and I'll give you my short, very snapshot look at it. I think that what's happened is there have been assumptions drawn about laws that were heavily weighted towards it's going to be a disaster and everyone's going to prison. And this has been done over the protests of the people who were enforcing the law, that it wasn't going to happen. We moderate everything. We negotiate almost everything. And that happened in Measure 11, which rippled out for 15 years. And finally, there's a recognition it stabilized. It happened with 57. And in fact, the last forecast for 57 that the forecaster did dropped 200 beds. Now, I think what one of the things that's going on here and why the forecaster is a little bit captured over time is that initially he has to get models for what it's going to look like. And the Criminal Justice Commission has been the instrument to do that. And they've been relying on the Criminal Justice Commission to tell them what the assumption should be. And we have not been in those conversations to say that's not right. So I think that's part of it. And that kind of, it goes back to what you're saying, is all these changes have made it harder because of that. I wish that weren't so.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I appreciate the answer. I think, if I heard you correctly, in a way, I think you proved my point, though, which is that we had Measure 11 enacted in 94. We have 10-year forecasts about what the impact is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then we've made changes to it. You know, we've made changes to Measure 11 in the past that have certainly mitigated the impact of it on prison growth. So,
mm-hmm.
And that's a choice we made. I think it's a little bit, I'm not sure it's fair to fault the forecaster, though, for getting it wrong, you know, at the outset, not anticipating that we made legislative changes to the measure. So,
Chair Garrett and I completely agree with that, members of the committee. I'm not saying it's the forecaster's fault. I'm saying that the conversation about the assumptions that were built in and the impacts of Measure 11 and the changes were wrong. They were wrong.
But they weren't as wrong as you might be suggesting, because part of the reason they ended up being wrong is because we made changes here.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying on top of that. Because every time you make a change, there has to be some assumptions drawn about what it's going to mean. And every time that's happened, the assumptions have been that it's going to result in way too many people being locked up. The conversation about that was wrong. And we have complained about it repeatedly. And we're saying now, that's the foundation of this. And if we allow this to play out, it's going to flatten. Because if we just stop changing the law for a while, and 57 is now in effect, and it's flattening. Measure 11 has been in effect. It's flattening. And that's what I'm saying. And it's not that the changes happen and that's not hard. Of course it is. It's the mechanism that drove the assumptions that I think were not balanced.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Representative Hicks and then Senator Winters. And then we got to move on.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the inmate population forecast, it might be accurate. It might not be accurate. Certainly, there's been a compelling case. But I don't want it to get lost within this conversation. I don't want there to be a perception that the inmate population forecast is equal to the prison cost forecast.
Right.
It's a factor, but it's one of many, many factors. I mean, for all I know, we could level out today and still go up $600 million over the next 10 years. I don't think anyone can remember the last time DOC made it through a biennium without having to go back to the E-board. And so that's all I wanted to say. And so thank you so much for all the work that's been done all around as far, in terms of inmate forecast. But so I just want to keep it in mind that cost is ultimately what I want to see focused on. So for what it's worth, thank you for.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Chair Olson. On the discussion on the caution in the report, I guess those of us who in this building are familiar with caution, because that's the same language that's used when we get our economic forecast and our revenue forecast. You know, I think we recognize that forecasting is not an exact science, and it's just that. But having said that, and trying to listen and trying to understand the argument, particularly when there are members that are part of the group that's actually kind of working and monitoring us through this, you know, when you find a flaw in a tool, do you have the opportunity to talk about that flaw and help to change that tool? That's one question, because historically, if this has been going on for how many years, you're telling me that you think it's flawed. And when we make legislative changes, I'm assuming that those assumptions are also built in to the forecasting. Is that correct?
She's looking at you, Don.
Yes.
I'm looking at the members who is a part of.
Well, Senator Winters, I can't speak for the state economist, but I'm guessing he would say it's a work in progress. We have made these observations. We have voiced our concerns and our cautions, and we continue to do so. I think that, it is clear from watching these forecasts every 6 months that it's a tool, but it is just that. It's a tool, and it needs to be looked at very, very carefully.
That's it. But that's the same thing that we look at. It's a tool when we get our economic forecast. I just need to try to, in my own head, put some things in perspective on forecasting, and when the economist tells us with caution, and whether that caution is coming out of this particular forecast. And so there's the highs and maybe not so high, and maybe we might get it right this time, but maybe not so right. And I think that's what you're saying. Only you're saying that traditionally it's been a lot higher than you thought that it should be. Am I getting it correct?
I don't believe Senator Winters, the state economist, is sounding any warning bells.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Next person that we have that's going to come up, it happens to be the Director of the Department of Corrections, Colette Peters.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colette Peters, Director of the Department of Corrections, and it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. I'm here to talk about some of the data findings from the Governor's Commission on Public Safety and cover some of the areas that I think have had some confusion wrapped around them. One of them being forecast, not to belabor the issue since we've been talking about it for a while, but I will touch on that. I will touch on the Department of Corrections cost per day, the governor's balanced budget, and how it's tied then to the work that was presented to you from the commission. These 2,000 vacant beds at the Department of Corrections and what that means, and the idea that we might be able to control the growth in corrections just through managing intakes. Okay. So with that, I will start with the forecast. And again, I appreciate the work that the district attorneys have brought forward. I appreciate DA Foote's comments that we might not be viewing this in like ways. I am not an economist, but I do sit on the forecasting committee. So I'm hoping that my perspective helps this conversation to some degree. I'll begin with some background, some of the questions that you all asked just a few moments ago, I think I'll be able to answer. The Oregon Office of Economic Analysis has been completing the prison population forecast since 1995. As Senator Winters pointed out, this is the same office that establishes your revenue forecast. Prior to 1995, as was stated on the record, the Department of Corrections completed the forecast. We recognized that this really needed to be done by a neutral, independent party. So an executive order and statute directs OEA to issue this forecast each April and each October. This allows an objective third party to ensure what we hope is an unbiased report. The inmate forecast uses a model which simulates inmates entering prison, their length of stay in prison, and their final release. The primary driver of the forecast is in the short term is the release rate of the existing prison population, as the district attorneys talked to just moments ago. In the long term, new intakes really drive that population trend. The rate of intakes and releases result in turnover of about half the inmate population every 2 years. The length of stay for inmates is critical in modeling these releases from prison. The fundamental information for estimating an inmate's length of stay, the inmate sentences, is known for most current inmates. With this sentence information, releases can be modeled in a semi-deterministic manner. It is important to note that the length of an inmate stay is not a simple fixed number of months that is known when they enter prison. Standard upper and lower bounds are computed by DOC based on how the inmate's sentences combine, but deviation then, both within and without those bounds, must also be statistically handled. The DA's referred to the complexity of this forecasting model, and it certainly is. The Corrections Population Forecast Advisory Committee was formed in 1990 to assist the Office of Economic Analysis in preparing estimates of criminal offender populations in Oregon. The governor appoints members of the committee for 4 terms based on the members' knowledge of the criminal justice system and trends that may affect the offender population. As was alluded to in the dialogue earlier, the advice from the advisory committee is supposed to form the basis for forecast assumptions regarding policy and practices in the criminal justice system and the impact of law and policy changes on the corrections populations. So in plain words, these are not supposed to just be formularies that are being adjusted over time. It really is supposed to be a dialogue with experts in the field that help determine and help us make that forecast as accurate as possible. The prison population depends on many factors, including the overall population of the state, but it also includes trends in criminal activity, the resources available to the criminal justice system, the areas of emphasis where most of those resources are targeted, as well as the penal codes and other law changes that you all spoke to. The impact of policy changes, such as the sentencing reforms brought by ballot measure 11, measure 57, have been particularly difficult to predict and have often led to large changes in the population outlook, as the DA's mentioned. The population forecast is based on an assumption that current laws will persist into the future, as Representative Garrett alluded to just moments ago. As such, any law implemented by voters or policymakers that affects the number or length in prison stays can change the forecast significantly. It often takes years before the impacts of those law changes are fully reflected in our prison population. Aside from periods following the significant changes to Oregon law, large movements in the prison population forecast have also been seen following shifts in nationwide crime trends and rates and changes in Oregon's migration trends as well. The long-term forecast has been accurate based on the information the analysts had at the time of their projection. I think this is what Representative Garrett was really getting to. Now, and with all due respect to the economists, and I've shared this with them, I think that they do this conversation a little bit of an injustice by using the economist term of art, which is error, that error, when describing a forecast that then doesn't meet the reality 10 years later. The reason the 10-year forecasts do not match today is because 10 years ago, the analysts did not predict that historic and sustained crime decline or Measure 57 or Measure 73. The short-term forecasts have been very accurate. The past 20 two-year forecasts have been off by an average of less than 1%. The forecasts released in October of 2012, our recent one, projects a growth of 2,300 beds by December 1, 2023. And while, as the DA suggested, it actually drove down by 200 beds, over the 10 years, the number actually went up. It was that short-term forecast that dropped down by about 200 beds. 35% of the growth that's projected, or 800 beds, is forecasted in the next 2 years. In fact, there was one day in December when the forecast and the reality actually matched to the number. It was December 20th for anyone that was interested in fact-checking that. And while we've been debating the accuracy of this forecast since the commission rolled out last May, it's important for us to remember that my prison population has grown by 378 inmates. I'd like to start the conversation around cost per day by setting aside a myth that I often hear, which is Oregon has one of the highest cost per days in the nation. We do not. It is ranked 27, as you can see in this slide, although I don't think Oregonians usually like to rest easy in the middle on the cost per day conversation. I think that's not bad, considering the fact that we are not a right-to-work state, but we are unionized. I also think it's a pretty profound number given the outcomes that we have. We have one of the lowest recidivism rates in the country. That being said, I am committed, and I have shared with almost each of you individually, to mitigating that cost per day. We are engaging in an organizational transformation over the next 12 to 18 months, where we are going to review every level of our organization and apply lean management methodology throughout the organization to see if we can find more efficiencies and be more effective. We'll attach all of that review to outcomes. So as we move in the era of outcome-based budgeting, we hope to be able to provide those data points for you. Further, I'm meeting with a group of sheriffs to see if they have ideas that might contribute to mitigating this rising cost per day and including them in the conversation. I think there is confusion around cost per day. So the clarifying point that I'd like to start with is that the cost per day is an outcome of our budget. It's not an input we use to determine our budget. The published average daily cost for an offender is determined each biennium after the end of the legislative session, after the end of the approval of the legislatively approved budget. For the current biennium, the average budgeted cost per day is $84.81. The current DOC model uses only direct costs for institution operations, and you can see those outlined in this chart. So we use central and statewide operation division functions, healthcare, treatment and programming, all of those things that attribute to what it costs to care for that individual inmate. What this does not include, it does not include community corrections funding, debt service, department-wide costs such as legal fees, DAS fees, financial and personnel staff, all of those variables that won't change if I have 15,000 inmates or 10,000 inmates. Those are just the standard costs of running the Oregon Department of Corrections. And that's the reason this separation is made in calculating cost per day, because those direct costs are what are impacted when we add additional inmates. So cost per day is really used not to determine what my budget looks like, but to help us budget for that growth in inmates. Now, there have been conversations around reducing the cost per day, and I want to talk just for a minute around why I disagree with arbitrary reductions to our cost per day. 24% of the department's budget passes through DOC and goes directly to community corrections. That leaves 76%. Of the 76%, 54% goes to personnel costs, which is salaries, benefits, and retirement. The remaining 46 goes to medical care, fuel and utilities, state government service charges, food and kitchen supplies, and then programming and facilities maintenance. All of those, while those are the areas where we're going to be looking at to see if we can find efficiencies, all of those things are going up across the nation, right, not just in prison. So we are going to take this conversation very seriously, but I wanted you to understand the difficulties associated with that. So while the governor's balanced budget caps the prison population and PERS reform, I have news to share with you today that probably won't be well received by this group or anyone, because our cost per day is going up regardless. We are leaving an era with no step increases and furloughs, and those drivers are going to increase my cost per day. And I think Representative Hicks alluded to that earlier. So now that I've described our cost per day and that it's an output and not an input, I'm going to share a slide with you that will now make me a little nervous, because we've actually projected what cost per day might be in the future given the variables that we have today. So we'll take a look here. On the left is our current cost per day at $84.81. The next is the projected 2013-2015 cost per day, taking into account the governor's balanced budget, which assumes the population cap at 14,600 and includes PERS reform. As you can see, the number increases from that $84.81. The third step is the projected 2013-15 cost per day without PERS reform and without the population cap. So while it's growing, the prison cap and the PERS reform do mitigate the growth in cost per day. And finally, the number on the right is the estimated cost per day for the 23-25 biennium, even assuming a population cap and the PERS reform carries through over the next 10 years. So as we talk about cost per day, it's important to note that we're talking about mitigating that rising cost per day. It is going up, and I think our obligation is to really focus on how we can mitigate that cost. This chart shows the difference between our 11-13 legislatively approved budget, our 13-15 agency request budget, and the governor's balanced budget. Moving from left to right again, our 2011-13 legislatively approved budget is approximately $1.4 billion. The second bar at approximately $1.6 billion is our agency request budget. To get there, we started with the 11-13 LAB. We removed the value of the mid-management reduction, which I'm sure you'll all remember, of $4.2 million. And we include the value of all our personnel services increases built into the fixed picks freeze, merit increases, and position roll-ups, inflation, restoration of the one-time vacancy savings, and our caseload based on the April 2012 forecast. Finally, the third column is the governor's balanced budget for the Department of Corrections, which is approximately $1.5 billion. What you see here is the GBB eliminates caseload growth because of the policy objective to cap the prison population, and does not include the policy option packages that we put forward. It assumes PERS reform and a prison population cap again at 14,600. I'll share with you briefly some of the details in the GBB as it relates to corrections. The governor's balanced budget reflects a nearly 21% reduction from the agency request budget. While not indicated on this slide, it reflects a 3.3% reduction from the governor's balanced budget at current service level. Our agency request budget includes a $4.2 million cut resulting from the abolishment of those management positions. So although I don't have a slide to talk through this, I wanted to mention briefly and have a conversation about this idea that Oregon has close to 2,000 vacant beds. We currently have 16,400 beds. That includes constructed and emergency beds, with about 14,200 adults in custody. This may appear to have 2,200 empty beds. However, the facts are a bit more nuanced, and I'd like to walk through that in just a minute. Of these 16,400 beds, more than 1,500 have no staffing or operating funding. These beds are simply not available without a large appropriation of funds from the legislature just to open half of the Deer Ridge beds, and 100 beds at Shutter Creek would cost approximately $37 million in the 2013-15 biennium. The vacant beds at Deer Ridge Correctional Institution, we have about 1,200 beds available. At the Oregon State Penitentiary, 176 at the minimum, OSPM. At Shutter Creek Correctional Institution, we have 100. So that totals about 1,500. So of the 16,400, I've just accounted for the gap of 1,500. The remaining vacant is what we use in order to handle the movement of inmates. And we regularly have between 600 and 800 beds at the Department of Corrections to manage that movement. At any given time, an inmate may need to move for medical, mental health, or disciplinary hearings or programming purposes. Approximately 60% of those vacant beds are in special purpose units, our infirmaries, programs, behavioral health, and several levels of our segregation beds. Housing in these units is responsive to specific needs and then not available for general purpose placement. Without these beds, then there's no place for a sick inmate or a dangerous inmate to be placed in segregation. The majority of the $30 million plus dollars in savings in the 13-15 biennium comes by not bringing those additional beds online. Only a small portion of that is to issue COPs for the continuation of Junction City. But based on the current forecast and our construction timeline, we would need to begin the construction at Junction City now in order to accommodate for that growth and the need for those beds in 2018. The next and last point that I'll raise with the committee is this idea that we would be able to manage the population growth, that 2,300 beds projected over a 10-year period, by just looking at either the front-end services and recidivism or the idea of managing intakes. I think that this proposal, while it has great policy pieces in it that we should be doing as a public safety community anyway, misunderstands some key facts about what drives prison growth and would not succeed in containing Oregon's prison population growth. It is true that when a prison population is growing, there are more prison intakes than there are releases. However, it is not true that we can close this gap by focusing on intakes alone. If every Oregon offender was sentenced to about the same time, Oregon would be able to control prison population growth by focusing on intakes alone, but we know that's not the case. Oregon offenders, like offenders in every other state, face a broad range of sentence lengths when they enter prison. Some incoming offenders are facing 1 year, others are facing 6 years. Therefore, to control prison growth, you must address the number of intakes and length of stay, or those bed months, as we've been referring to them as of late. By way of example, if we propose equalizing the number of intakes and releases by finding a way to reduce the number of intakes coming into prison from community supervision, also referred to as revocations, the population has a length of stay of approximately 20 months. Average length of stay in Oregon is double that. It's 40 months. So stopping 30 revocations every month would certainly have an effect on the prison population, but not to the degree that we would need to right-size what happens with length of stay. I think we also need to look at recidivism. Reducing recidivism is one of the primary goals of our evidence-based practices. And as critical as it is for public safety that we invest in evidence-based practices to reduce recidivism, this alone won't curb this projected population growth. This is because evidence-based practices, unfortunately, are no match for the growth rates that we're predicting. The best evidence-based practices can reduce recidivism by 30%. So even at its most effective, evidence-based practices have a significant but still limited effect on the supervised offender population to which they are applied. So we only need to look at Oregon's recent history to understand the limits of evidence-based practices on prison growth, which has been driven by increasingly aggressive sentencing policy. In the last decade, Oregon has achieved an unprecedented and remarkable reduction in recidivism, approximately 19%. This is, of course, envied by others across the nation, but over the decade, our prison population, even with that recidivism reduction, has grown by more than 50%. So with that, I finished the remarks that I prepared for you today, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Director Peters, hello.
Hello.
Could we return to slide 5 for a moment? And this is your pie chart. There are so many, each one of these could bear lengthy testimony, which I will not request, but I just want to touch on the two largest, security and housing and medical services. So security and housing, can you just briefly describe, I know in many of your institutions you have a guard to inmate ratio of roughly 1 to 135. In other words, one guard is watching 135 inmates at any given time, probably very nervously. And could you describe some of your costs? So a lot of these, and you do have a lot of overtime. I'm not going to ask you to do that. Probably by somehow adjusting that ratio, you could probably adjust your costs possibly downward, but not having to pay these people time and a half because you don't have, anyway. But could you actually just describe for the committee some of your mental health and physical health toll that comes on your staff as a result of that, and to the extent that that would drive cost. Also, medical services, 15%. We remember that's all general, nearly all general fund dollars competing with K-12 and other health care obligations. It's not offset by federal matching. And just for that, can you simply tell the story of the paraplegic? I think that tells it all.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Certainly. Thank you, co-chairs, Representative Hicks. So I will say those correctional officers are standing there with great confidence supervising those offenders, for the record. But the ratios of staff to our inmate population often surprise people. And it certainly was a stark reminder, having left the Oregon Youth Authority, where the staffing patterns are very different compared to what they are at the Department of Corrections. So in our new facilities, the standard ratio is one officer to 108 offenders on those units. Now it's 130 because of our temporary and emergency beds. So in the last biennium, that has grown dramatically in many of our units across the country. If you go to some of our units in our older facilities, like at the Oregon State Penitentiary, the ratio will surprise you even more. We will have one officer on a cell block with 580 offenders. With movements constantly occurring throughout the day. Now, we do that in Oregon safely because, of my opinion on how we manage the offender population. It is through interaction. We ask our officers to role model for those offenders, redirect their behavior, and treat them with respect. And their primary tool is their voice. And they use the least amount of means possible to manage that population, and they do it well. They do it with an awful lot of stress. And we're just starting to realize the impact of that stress. Unfortunately, we have had too many suicides over the last 2 years at the Oregon Department of Corrections, a rate much higher than the general population in Oregon. So the former director, Max Williams, began looking into this further. We're behind our law enforcement partners in studying the impacts of stress on our correctional officers in Oregon and across the country. We've engaged in a contract with OHSU and PSU to help us understand what this means. And unfortunately, the preliminary results are staggering. We have 1 in 3 of our correctional officers have symptoms of PTSD. We know that with PTSD comes higher levels of smoking, drinking, divorce rates. And the National Institute of Corrections also has data that, although we are verifying, suggests that after 20 years of working in this business, the average lifespan of a correctional officer is 58 years, as opposed to the nation's 75. So we're working on creating a wellness plan. OHSU and PSU are helping us put a wellness plan together. We're piloting it right now in 2 facilities. We're hoping that if it proves effective, we'll be able to spread it across the department, share it with our public safety partners here in Oregon, and then also across the country. So while budget might be one of our greatest challenges, the safety and wellness of our staff is my biggest concern, and something we're working really hard to help change. On the budget piece, you highlight the medical services piece. We spend as much on medical services as we do on community corrections in the state of Oregon. It is costly. We have offenders who come to our care and custody 10 years, biologically 10 years older than their chronological age. And while my aging population isn't the majority of my population, it's my fastest growing population. And with that comes increase in health care costs. We also have individuals that come to us with very difficult and very costly care requirements. We have an offender in our care and custody right now who is a quadriplegic. He can only communicate to us by clicking. He has no movement whatsoever. He has no medical hope of any recovery, and he is costing our system currently $50,000 every month. So while we're working really hard to mitigate our costs, our health care costs, we're doing a great job kind of acting as a CCO, even though we're not one, trying to manage health care. There are still issues that that are hard to manage. So thank you.
Director Peters, some members might not be aware of the eligibility issues around federal Medicare, Medicaid for people in DSC. Could you just speak to that?
Certainly. Currently, we do not collect Medicare or Medicaid for the offenders in our custody, and the federal law actually says that while they are in prison, we cannot have access to those programs. In the past, we have reviewed the availability of those funds once we have to take an offender from inside our prison and move him outside or her outside for specialty care or hospital care following a surgery, as an example. And the federal law allows that once an offender is outside the prison gate and in a hospital receiving care for after 24 hours, that we could have access to Medicaid. However, the original assessment was that because we have now engaged in a third-party health administrator who helps us negotiate those out-of-prison in-hospital costs, that we might lose the authority to utilize that third-party health care administrator, which substantially, the savings we receive from that are substantially higher than any Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements we would receive. We've been working very closely with OHA, and we think there might be an avenue to have both. So we're still in the research stage of that, but not the early research stages, and we're hoping to have an answer for you on that soon. Thank you.
Senator Brzezinski.
Paulette, could you give us a little more information? You give us an example of your extreme of the medical care, $50,000 per month, $600,000 per year for one inmate. Can you tell us a little bit more? I'm not sure what you can share with us as to that particular individual, what they're suffering from, what their convictions for, their, you know, just trying to get a little bit more information grasping around that and what they're, how long they're going to be on our obligations.
Certainly. Co-chair, specifically Senator Brzezinski. With that specific individual, the 24-hour care that's required for someone who is a quadriplegic is substantial. It requires on-site care, constant supervision of his physical abilities, and also caring for any emergencies that come along that come naturally with that dysfunction. I think that the $50,000 range a month is one of our extreme examples, but they certainly occur. We had another individual just arrive at intake who is going to cost us, for the entirety of her stay, $20,000 a month in medication. And standards of care are always changing. And we subscribe to a community standard of care, which we're required legally to do. So when new drugs come forward, for example, and there's a new Hep C drug right now that has proven great success, we're required to provide that in our formulary of care. Originally, when that new drug came out last year, the projection was that it was going to cost us about $6 million a biennium to distribute that drug in the Department of Corrections.
Senator Winters.
I do have a follow-up, and perhaps, Colette, you can, because we requested it and the public safety ways and means of sharing with this body the number of million-dollar cases, medical cases that exist, because I know that they're there. The current medical budget it requested is at $239 million, and Colette's working with us to try to see what we can do with both the aging population and some of this medical cost that we're talking about.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, I'd be happy to provide that information to the committee. Certainly, there is always we are always at risk for litigation as we manage infirmary-level care or hospital-level care in many of our prisons across the state, and certainly clinical care in each one of our facilities. So once we've finalized that data, I'll forward it to this committee as well. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, co-chairs. Thank you, committee members.
So, Scott Taylor, if you'd come up, and Kiki Parker-Rose, if you'd also come up.
I'm Scott Taylor, representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and I was a member of the Commission on Public Safety.
Co-chairs, Chair, my name is Kiki Parker-Rose, and I'm the Director of Klamath County Community Corrections.
What we wanted to talk about today, or what we were encouraged to talk about, was probation and parole. It's an area that people have heard about but may not know much about, or if you do, we're just going to try to roll through this quickly. Of all the functions in the correction system, community corrections is the largest, most cost-effective, and one of the system's best options for achieving crime reduction. I am very biased about this. As I said, I'm the president of the Community Corrections Director Association. I'm the president of the American Probation Association. And prior to this honor, I actually worked with the Department of Corrections and got to manage some of those populations you were just talking about. So this is a place I really enjoy the community, and it's where we work. We started the what we think is a foundation for Oregon success, and I was typing so fast that the dates may be a little wrong. So about 1995, we started this process. We developed advancements for evidence-based practices around the nation. Yes, go back one, or two, or three. One, go back one. So we started this. And Oregon is acknowledged around the nation for its evidence-based practices. We also have collaboration that's very unusual throughout the nation, and that's both with our system partners and with our partners in the community I'll talk about in just a moment. And we have, as you passed, some legislation, and we have continually focused on the idea of doing what works, and we've actually moved from a philosophy of trail 'em, nail 'em, and jail 'em to one of trying to manage people in the community and get change. For a quick review, these are the demographics of our population. On any given day, we have 32,000 adult offenders, felony offenders. About 55% of those are on probation, or 18,000 of them. About 80% do not reoffend. We have 42% on post-prison supervision or parole, about 13,000 people, and 75% of those, on average, do not recidivate. And when we say recidivate, we mean 3 years felony conviction. About 2% are on local control, and that's about 600 people. That's our highest failure rate, but 67% do not recidivate. I would just make a footnote. This is a population that used to come to prison for a year or less. They now remain in the community. So what we've seen over the last 5 years, as Director Peters talked about, is we've continued to see a reduction in recidivism. In probation, we've gone down about 5%, from 25% to 20%. And on parole, we've gone from 31% down to 26%. 40% of our population is statute crimes, 35% are person crimes, and 25% are property crimes. When you look at this compared to the prison, you'll notice the percentages are different in each of those categories, but if you multiply it by the raw numbers in every category, it's a larger population that we manage in the community. So it's the primary, we we believe that we are the primary response of the criminal justice system and that we have 32,000 people and there's 14,000 in the prison. So we think we are the most frequently used. So what is an ideal community corrections evidence-based practice as we talk about? Well, we do meta-analysis all over the place. We look at thousands of studies or hundreds or tens, depending on who you are, and look at, is there something in there that tells us it works? We happen to be right next door to the Washington State Institute of Public Policy that many of you heard from and seen, and they are one of the leaders in actually mining down, doing the in-depth work, and then putting cost-benefit to that. We pay great attention to that. So what are some of the things you have going on in Oregon? Risk tools. We use all sorts of risk tools. We'll talk about those in a moment. We focus on higher risk clients, and I'll talk about why we do that, but research would tell us that's where we should spend our time and resources. We have a reasonable caseload sizes. We believe in swift and certain. We believe in available treatment services and programming. We try to use punishments and rewards at a 4-to-1 ratio. It's actually backwards, so it should be 4 rewards to every 1 punishment. And collaboration among the system partners. And here, I think what's different when we talk about that, the system partners include victims, the court, the DAs, the defense, but even a larger population are our housing, our treatment, our mentoring, our education, our employment, families, and the community are all part of our daily supervision. And so it's a pretty large group invested in making some of these changes. We refer to this as R&R. These are the principles we drive by. Risk level, determine the risk of recidivating through the use of validated tools. We do that in Oregon. Need, we have found out over time that there are specific criminogenic factors. Those are factors that actually lead to criminal behavior. And if we can identify those and focus on those rather than other things, we actually can begin to move and change that criminal behavior and reduce future crime. And responsivity, trying to engage the offender in the most effective way, so trying to be a better understanding. And each time we've looked at the research around these, they just keep working. So risk tools, I won't bore you with those, but we have a whole bunch of them we use here in Oregon. People often want to talk to us and see how we put those together in packages because of the results we get. And one of the examples of this is we've recently moved to what is called the Public Safety Checklist, developed by the Criminal Justice Commission, the Department of Corrections, and the Community Corrections Directors in partnership. And this looked at 300,000 some people, did some analysis, narrowed it down to another group of 50,000, then down to 5,000. And what it shows you here is that if we use the risk tool properly, you'll see that that very low percentage, we have about 8% of the offenders and a chance of recidivism of 9%. And you go all the way to the far end, and you'll see that we can take 5% of the folks and figure out who they are, and they have a 54% chance of recidivating. So if I were to take you to the casino with me and ask you who you want to bet on today, that's what we're doing every day with the size of the population we manage, and this is how we start to walk through that. We try to keep track of how effective our tools are, and to be honest, sometimes in the budgeting model, we have to make decisions about where those lines are drawn so that our staff can properly manage the highest risk people. The criminogenic need identifies the issues related to further criminal behavior, as I talked about, and they're dynamic factors, and so they can be changed. And there are things we work at, and we try to have all of our treatment providers be familiar with those, try to focus on those. And these are not the conditions most often made conditions of supervision. So I've been in the business a while, and the conditions were here before I got here. So we use conditions that at the time seemed to make sense. We are now learning that some of those conditions are not necessarily related to future criminal behavior or to even protecting the community. So there's a movement around the nation to re-examine what those conditions should be and what they're driven by. And some of those assessments I talked about are what are starting to drive the actual conditions of supervision. We believe strongly in swift and certain. This is where in Oregon we have structured sanctions. And this is based on, we first tested this in Coos County and then in Jackson County, and we kept finding the same results. It then became the statewide model for structured sanction is now replicated around the nation. And what we are basing this on is we continue to find that the length of time is not as important as a swift and certain element. And the severity of the response is not related to the impact. So that means alternative sanctions are just as effective as jail frequently, and that allows us to manage the population differently locally. And what you'll see here in just a moment is that medium risk is often made worse by longer stays in jail. So we did a study. Go ahead and push again. And the orange is the high. And you can see what this chart shows you is from 0 to 30 days, 31 to 60 days, 60 days plus. We really don't get an impact in recidivism by the length of stay. But you take that blue column, and the longer they stay in jail, the worse they get. And so this is another example of really studying the who and the what and are we getting the effect we want that we thought in our visceral response this would actually get you what you want. When we look at it and analyze it, we're not finding that. We're finding that if we want the change, once we're done with the accountability piece and the punishment piece, the actual change is more affected by us managing that length of time and doing the swift and certain response. There's a study that just came out from the Center Council of State Governments Justice Center, and they looked at three cities down in California, L.A., Sacramento, and Redlands. And what they were concerned about was in 2009, California passed a law that said that if you were a low-risk person in prison, they would release you and you could not be revoked back to prison. And the police chiefs all in the area thought that would really lead to a crime wave. So they did one of the largest studies ever done on the population, both general and supervision. And what they found was that overall in the population, because of the crime rate decline that's been going on, it was an 18% decline. But those being supervised actually had a 40% decline. Again, pointing out that the people that are properly managed and in the community can be done safely. And that they also found that the assessment, that risk level I was talking about, was an effective indicator of rearrest. And if they were targeting the high-risk people in their watching and what was going on, they were more effective. And the Multnomah County example is just, when we talk about collaboration, this is an opportunity where the Portland Police, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, my office, the Department of Community Justice, and a variety of the community members effectively work together to try and manage the issues, the full spectrum of issues that come with us trying to deal with the gang issues. And that's what that collaboration is about. So it's not just, when we talk about community corrections, it's not just probation and parole independent. So when we looked at the Commission on Public Safety, there were some recommendations in there that we think tied directly to what we've just been talking about, the transitional leave and earn time. Why does that make sense? Because it supports a successful entry and provides rewards. And we are now just learning at some recent work that's coming out on incentives versus punishments, and we're finding that the incentives are even more powerful than the punishment in getting the change in people. And we can structure those in the same way we do the sanctions. Community corrections earn discharge. This is, again, the idea of focusing on the higher risk and letting those people that have kind of got the message and are not going to come back to us be done with us. Structured sanctions, you've had structured sanctions here for a long time. It's very effective. It reduced the need for the indigent court costs, and it moves the system through the jails and everywhere else very rapidly. Gives us some opportunity to use different sanctions. And then supervision conditions, they promote connection to the treatment and the programming I talked about earlier. So the 10-to-1 ratio is basically, you saw the slide by Director Peters, and what we have found is that our basic per day cost is about $8 or something right now. And so if you compare that to the $80, it's a 10-to-1 ratio. So every person that we can manage in the community is a 10-to-1 ratio. And when we surveyed, as Community Corrections, we surveyed our directors around the state and asked them how was this year, what had they lost comparatively, and what percentage of the counties described a loss in these areas. 70% were experiencing a employee reduction. 50% had A&D outpatient slots being reduced. 46% had mental health services being reduced. 46% had restitution collection declining. 32% had lost some jail capacity, and 26% had lost housing. Those are all, as we do each of these fiscal cuts, that's where we begin to lose the infrastructure and the capacity to deal with the very discussion we're having about how do we stop the growth or at least slow it. And we cannot do that if we continue to cut the infrastructure we have. So I guess in closing, we think community services are a cost-effective solution. When you compare the cost per day of incarceration to community supervision, we operate at about 10% of the cost. However, we must not confuse being cost-effective with being cost-free. We've already witnessed in some states the organized chaos that can occur when transition from institution to community is unplanned and underfunded. Evidence-based practice shows that effective community supervision can only be achieved with an appropriate mix of supervision, sanctions, and services. Community supervision is investment, and we do our entire field a disservice when funds are not made available to deliver best practices. Unlike incarceration, whose primary function is incapacitation, good community supervision can change an offender's future behavior, and when implemented properly, community supervision reduces recidivism, reduces victimization, and reduces taxpayer expenditures. And Kiki is going to talk to you specifically about some work we were doing in Klamath Falls.
Co-Chair Winters, Krasanski, Garrison, and Olson. My name again is Kiki Parker-Rose. I'm with Klamath County Community Corrections. In 2007, Klamath County Community Corrections received a grant as well as entered into a contract with the Oregon Department of Corrections to bring offenders back to the community 6 months prior to their release from prison. This was one of the first reentry transitional programs in Oregon. We had a 36-bed work-release reentry facility, which is located in the bottom of our parole and probation department. It's a dormitory-style facility. We had 24 work-release beds and then 12 Department of Corrections beds. The program allowed the corrections counselor to conduct reach-in services. We identified offenders that had risks and needs that we could meet within the program. We scheduled the offender to transfer to the reentry program from the institution the 180 days prior to their actual release. This is a picture of the inside of the facility. The services we provided were the assessments and screening. This included at the time an OCMS risk assessment. Now we use the PSC. And an LSCMI screen. We also did an assessment for alcohol and drug treatment. We provided supervised job search, cognitive skills, transitional skills, education and vocational services, work release and housing assistance. We had a case manager assigned to every offender that came into our facility. We addressed their criminogenic risk factors, as Mr. Taylor mentioned. We created an evolving transition plan for each offender so that they would be successful when they went back into our community in Klamath County. We provided a supportive environment to identify and address the barriers through assessment and case planning, as well as the individual barriers each person posed as they came into our facility. We provided group and individual counseling, which focused, again, on those criminogenic risk factors. We used a program called Moral Reconciliation Therapy Curriculum and a transitional skills curriculum. We identified and removed the potential barriers for the successful transition to the community. We provided family counseling, where we actually had a contract for services for a local provider to come in and help with our kiddos that were the kids of these offenders, as well as perhaps the victim or significant other or wife. We assisted with the folks getting motor driver's license or identification cards from DMV prior to their release. We helped them get their Social Security cards. Some of them attended community college. We provided relapse prevention services. We allowed for supervised job search. And we worked closely with our Department of Human Services because many of these folks had a Department of Human Services caseworker because some of the kiddos in the situations had been taken out of the care and custody of the offender and placed with perhaps a significant other or the wife. We also connected our folks to self-sufficiency programs and helped them fill out their OHP paperwork so that when they were released, we had the ability to go ahead and provide medication, which many of our folks had some sort of medication issue. We provided a structured, pro-social, community-based outreach. We had self-help groups. We had NA and AA within our facility. We had a local church that provided services for us. We had supervised recreational activities, family integration, mentoring, safe housing, sponsors, and we have a significant population of Native Americans in our community, and so we were made sure that we were able to provide some cultural and heritage issues for those folks. We sent our folks out on a supervised work crew for the first 90 days that they came to us. This is an example of a fence they built in North Klamath County. It allowed them to repay the community through the supervised work crew. We taught them pro-social skills. They learned transferable job skills. When we developed an awareness of giving back to the community, we provided a sense of accomplishment, and and they got to see the work that was completed. We provided all those services, and we had extremely good outcomes. We had 67 participants from 2007, and this slide was through 2010. We shut the facility down April 15th of 2011. At that time in 2010, 67 participants, 83.6% successfully completed the program. 75% were attending school or employed. 100% were released to clean and sober housing. And 85.7% of these folks remain conviction-free within our community. What I have before you today is just a brief slideshow of the program that we had, but it was a very impactful program, and we had very good outcomes, but we didn't do it by ourselves. Without the community partners in our, that we have in our community, this would have never happened. We had services being provided by folks for free. We had the support of our district attorneys and local law enforcement. Our court systems were willing to modify sentence orders that then went to the time comp unit of the Department of Corrections to make certain folks eligible. These types of programs are successful, and any community with collaboration is able to provide some sort of reentry services for the folks coming back. 93% of them are coming back to us. Regardless of what the present forecast is, we know that 93% of these people are going to come back to our community. And we know that historically, providing or lack of providing the LICRA mentality, if you will, the one-size-fits-all for those folks coming back doesn't work. We can't expect that they're going to change on their own, and we have the tools and services at Community Corrections at that level to provide services that we can reduce recidivism rates. I will tell you from our community, not only did we close down this reentry program, our department had 39 employees on July 1st, 2010. Today there are 18 of us providing services for 725 convicted felons in our community. Our department no longer provides misdemeanor supervisions. The majority of misdemeanors are domestic violence cases, drunk driving cases, and some sex offenses. We don't have the ability to provide those services anymore. We cut sex offender contracts. We reduced batterers intervention treatment program contracts. We pay for no alcohol and drug treatment in our community. And all of our funding comes from the state. We have been hit hard by the budget cut, the $26 million that Community Corrections lost in the last biennium. And we know that we can do better. We know that we can be successful with the tools that we have in the community. But we need to ensure that the baseline funding level for our agencies is appropriate so we can continue to provide those services. Otherwise, we'll have 93% of those folks coming back to nothing. Thank you.
Questions?
I don't have a question. I just have a...
Sarah Winters.
Because I've heard Kiki before, and and each time that you've shared with us the success of the work that's been done in Klamath Falls, and I just to continue reminding us that 93% returns back to the community, and that the work that was being done before all the budget cuts occurred was successful. I think we need to hear it more and more in this building, that the community corrections over time, we tend to forget the partner that's out there that's doing a lot of the work. And it's that piece that's in the community that has a positive impact on this whole discussion that we're talking about recidivism or not to recidivate. And Marion County is also has started a reentry, and I know of some of the other counties, and it would be just really a tragedy because as we talk about the input into DOC, you're on the other end of talking about keeping the output from going back into the system. So I just want to thank you for your comments and sharing with us the success that you had, and I feel very bad that you've had to reduce some of your services.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in terms of what the future of the justice system may be looking like, some of the innovations that are being attempted, I do want to take this opportunity to ask Ms. Parker-Rose whether she can tell us a little bit about the Veterans Court and that kind of philosophy down in Klamath County, that your experiences with that, please, could you just impart?
Sure.
to us.
Sure. Co-chairs, Representative Hicks. The Veterans Court began October of 2011, I believe. There were 10 of us that were sent to Buffalo, New York to receive training on implementing a Veterans Court in our community. We've done that. We have an extremely collaborative working relationship. There is no financial services coming in from the outside. All of us that are sitting at the table are there because our fingerprints are going to be on these folks anyhow. The DA is going to be prosecuting them. The defense attorney is going to be representing them. The judge is going to be sentencing them. The law enforcement officer is going to be arresting. Community corrections will be providing services. So we've partnered with the VA out of our local VA and also the VA in Jackson County. And we've been able to bring those folks that have a history in the military into the program. I believe we've brought in about 60. I may be a little high on that. Three have been unsuccessful, and we've got about 14 successes thus far. The importance of Veterans Court for us is that was really a link where we never thought about utilizing veteran services to get some of these treatment programs for our folks. And a lot of our folks, especially our people that are now returning, have traumatic brain injury. We're seeing a lot of PTSD. And so we're able to connect them early within the day they're arrested in jail. We have a form that's filled out at our jail, so we get notification that we have a vet in jail. That's sent to the VA. We do a staffing every Tuesday, and we're bringing those folks in and getting quick response and treatment services to that population. We're very proud of our program. And, you know, I'll just say this again. I kind of bring the rural perspective, and it's a tool that we have where we can look at what are the services out there. You know, we think traditionally of just alcohol and drug treatment and just batterers treatment or just sex offender treatment. But there's a lot of agencies that, again, have their fingerprints on the same folks that we're working with. And if we're reaching out to our community and finding out what services are out there, we have the ability to be very successful. Okay. So I appreciate you asking about Veterans Court.
One follow-up. So in your opinion, is there a taxpayer savings tied to Veterans Court?
Representative Hicks, absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Okay, Kiki, Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the informational hearing at that time, this time, and we're up for next Wednesday at 5:30 here, and so we're adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.